G'day. We'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the Andal land, the Wurundjeri people, and we're glad that we've been scheduled in the same session because we have some kind of some similar subject matter, I guess, but very, very different approaches, very different ways of getting digital storytelling done, and we're actually going to use this opportunity to really question, I think, some of the choices that get made in the real world when somebody funds or supports digital storytelling projects, because I think we need to move beyond the kind of idealised version of it where there's this thing called digital storytelling and it's magic and it's the same everywhere, because it's just not, and it's hard as well. So we're going to talk about a recent project that we did. It was a kind of a multi-stakeholder collaboration, but a genuine collaboration with the State Library of Queensland that was designed to use digital storytelling and oral history to capture responses to the apology on February 13th this year by the Prime Minister. Before I actually talk about the project, I just want to frame this in kind of the cultural significance of this event. You all know about it, you all shared in some kind of experience of it, but you all had an individual experience on that day. And at the same time, I think we focus very much on Kevin Rudd's actual performance of the apology as an event, but I'd like to think about it as an event that's much broader than that. It's an event that's produced out of personal stories, and that produced a huge range of different perspectives and debates leading up to that actual official apology and afterwards as well. And interesting for me as a kind of cultural scholar is this idea that, in fact, the apology itself is is just the tip of the iceberg. It's the performance of an act of listening or a long period of finally listening to a wide range of personal stories. So I'd like to think about the project that we did as kind of making that point, that the apology itself is not so much about, although, you know, very significant in terms of public policy terms, the apology itself is actually more of a representation of what all of these individual stories mean. And so, just to quickly frame the multi-institutional nature of this project itself. This was very much driven by the State Library of Queensland, which is part of the Queensland government, so that raises some interesting issues for the project right there, which we were just naive about, really. We thought we were just going to do good and it will all be fine. So the State Library of Queensland, as well as having a very, very beautiful building, as you can see there. This was a collaboration between some people working within Indigenous Library Services and within a section of the library called Heritage Collections. Now, the background to this is that the Heritage Collections area had been primarily concerned, I think, with recording, you know, important aspects of Queensland's history, and there had been a recent shift within that unit of the library to include much more kind of oral history and personal histories as part of what it means to think of Queensland's cultural heritage. So it's a bit of a shift from kind of official versions of history to personal individual ones. And so there was some funding available and also some recommendations in a report that Helen and I did for them, saying that, you know, perhaps as part of your collections development policy, it might be good to think about collecting and actually actively commissioning and proactively working with communities to produce some more sort of personal history material that could then go into the collection. And so in about May or June, they had this idea independently of us that using digital storytelling and oral history to capture a wide range of responses to the apology. They had a small amount of money, so it was a small pilot project, that this would be a good idea. And so they got us on board to help out, along with facilitators, including Samir Gowdy, sitting right here, who represent some kind of significant Indigenous media and cultural organisations in Brisbane. So the hope was that we would kind of be training or you know, introducing digital storytelling into the toolkit of people who are existing advocates and very, very active kind of media professionals in this space, and that perhaps that we might embed capacity to do digital storytelling for other purposes around the community, but also that this would act as a pilot project so that more responses to the apology could be created and captured using these methods. And actually, I think I've changed my mind about the order of things. I think I'd like you to talk about... Helen's going to introduce each of the
stories.
And then I'm going to reflect a bit about... on the methodology and some of the issues and things we can learn about how we might do things differently.
Okay, we had a big list of people we started with that could have been involved in the project, and it's really hard with digital storytelling, as any of you know who's tried to do it, to get people involved for the amount of time that you need to get them involved to actually commit to coming in and doing the stories, etc. is a big ask out of people's lives that are very busy. So the people that we had in the end were all people involved in some way in the community as well, and they're all very busy, but they all gave us their time, which is great. Tiger Bales. To some of you might know Tiger Bales. He was one of the key people involved in establishing the Aboriginal Tent City in the early 1970s. He also worked for Radio Redfern in the 1980s and then moved up to Brisbane, back to Brisbane, where he's from Queensland he's from originally, to be general manager of 4AAA up there, which is a training, which has also, through him, become a training centre for... communication and broadcasting for Indigenous people. And, you know, he's got his finger in lots of pies. He's been on lots of boards and committees, and he's, you know, Father of the Year, and, you know, he's got many, many things. He's really a great advocate for young Indigenous people, and he travels a lot around the state and around Australia, actually, just trying to empower young people. The next one was Jeremy Rupp.
We're going to play them on.
Do you want to? Okay, right, great.
Did you want to say anything about the story, or just play the story?
No, I just think play the story, and I would.
It's a finely tuned.
Yeah, and I think. Well, I just think it's just interesting to add that everyone did their own story how they wanted to, and often, you know, Jean and I weren't in the room when any of this was being done because we used Indigenous artists and creative people like Samir to actually. Be the people who were doing the interviewing or helping with the photography, etc. And they're all very capable in their own ways, but some of them hadn't used digital storytelling, so it was just really, like Jean said, extending their own capabilities in that area. Hang on. There you go.
Well, the day of the apology was the 30th of February 2008. I was sitting in the press gallery in Parliament House, watching the Prime Minister as he presented his apology. To look around that chamber and see the galleries full of people, black faces, white faces, people that I knew, people that I didn't know. And then to look down on the floor of the chamber itself and see those elders from the Stolen Generations that were acknowledged. Those elders representing many, many more people of Stolen Generations, seeing them sitting on the floor of the chamber, a few feet away from where the Prime Minister was presenting or delivering his apology. It was an historical moment, because for the last 12 years or more, we've had a very mean-spirited Prime Minister. Sorry was not a part of his vocabulary. People were very emotional. Blacks and whites had tears streaming down their faces. Others just had a watery eye, like myself. It brought a tear to a lot of eyes. And I was thinking of my grandfather, Sam Watson, taken away along with a lot of other young boys of the same age group. He was taken away from Nebo, taken by white pastoralists that came around in a horse and cart. And those young boys were just grabbed and thrown in the back of that cart. there was already Mum again. And the impact on my mother and her brothers and sisters, it took them a long time to find out about their country, their language, their songs and dances. And Grandfather Sam was flogged by a dog chain, tied up by a dog chain, flogged by that dog chain if he spoke the language or sung any of the songs or done any dances. So that cultural business ceased when he was taken away. And that's who that apology was meant for, people like Grandfather Sam Watson. And there's many of those people across the country. Almost every Aboriginal family in this country has that experience in their family somewhere along the line. That step taken by the Prime Minister with his apology on that day has made a lot of mainstream Australians feel it is now okay to recognise the struggle of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in this country. As opposed to the previous Prime Minister, where we had racists coming out of the woodwork, it's created a change, it's a new era in our time. And mind you, saying sorry is only the very first step, but it's a major acknowledgement. It was a major event for us, but we've got a long way to go.
It was really good, actually. You never get sick of listening to his voice. It's fantastic. Obviously in radio. He's a great voice. It was really good too being at the State Library, because we had the opportunity to have access to the original archive material and manuscripts and documents, etc. And so when you see images and like that coming through, that was because we had those files available to us, and we were able to use anything we wanted to. So it was a good way to mix up their photos with the archives. Okay, Jeremy. Jeremy's an interesting young lad. He's from an organisation called ACPA. He was a student there, which is... ACPA's the Aboriginal Centre for Performing Arts in Brisbane. And it was very interesting having the different aged participants. And this was a really interesting one, because Jeremy didn't realise that he was from... there was a stolen generation. So that was really interesting, being in a room with people who've been sort of... fighting for Aboriginal rights for the last, 40 years. It was a real wake-up call to them and about their own people, own young people, etc. So it was a really interesting week. But anyway, Jeremy's story is a bit different. They're all good, though.
My name's Jeremy Robinson, and I grew up in New South Wales in a town outside of Wagga, or Wagga Wagga. The town is called Coolman. I did primary school, moved back and forth from New South Wales to Queensland, New South Wales, Queensland, New South Wales, Queensland. With my mum being Aboriginal and my dad being Chinese as well, I never really grew up on liking both sides either. I just stuck straight in one society. Because I never grew up with racism or hate or like... Well, I grew up with plenty of hate. What kid doesn't, right? But not growing up with racism or being torn by two worlds, white and black. When I first came to ACPA, I thought everything was going to be cool, that nothing about personal life or personal history brought in. You're there to do a job. But being there for so long, you get an awareness that there is racism, not just from one side, but from both. There are stereotypes of Aboriginal people, but also stereotypes of other people as well. I don't really call other people like... there's only black and white, because everybody knows there's more than just two colours in life. Well, everybody has to live in grey. Why should everybody live just black and white? But when it comes to talking about the sorry day and stuff like that, truthfully, I didn't even know what stolen generation was until basically last year. I heard that it was something bad that happened in Aboriginal history, that something was going on and that people were taken. That's all I heard. I didn't realise it was stretched so far. Coming here and learning more about it, I realised that Kevin Rudd didn't need to say it, shouldn't have had that responsibility. It should have been said when these terrible crimes actually happened. Why did we need to wait so long? If the sorry was said back then and that next step was taken, where would we be now?
Well, we loved working with Jeremy. He was great. And I just love how all the photos are, if you've got teenage kids that have been taken, like, and all on his MySpace site, and you know, he said just get some more images off MySpace, but they're all of him at parties, so no, we won't use those ones, Jeremy.
There's heaps of photos, they're all on Bebo.
Yeah, all, you know, his mates. Anyway, the next one, Natalie. Don't know. Natalie Alberts is the manager of the Musgrave Community Centre in West End, in Brisbane.
It's on the apology on the red bit. No, it's on here.
So, yep. So Natalie's story is different again, and again, she had a lot of her own images, and she got some from other members of family, etc. And when they made them, it was quite interesting because they, we let them, we helped them if they wanted help, but they certainly had a private viewing first, like they weren't released for everyone to look at until they were really happy with them. We went and saw them each, personally to make sure that they were happy with them and how the images were put together. They came up with the ideas of how they particularly wanted it. Some of them had more time to actually make them more themselves than others. So we just worked with everyone to make sure that their stories were how they wanted to be depicted. So, Natalie, you're doing at the top.
Yeah, but now the screen resolution is all ugly.
It's okay.
I think for me, looking at that, the news articles leading up to that week, and it wasn't until actually, you know, we're getting close to that date that I actually looked at it and heard and listened and then realised what it meant for my family, you know? Just brought up all those emotions, that pain, that old history of hurt. And you know, that experience of my mother, my grandmother, and what her mother went through. And then to see that my family's today, looking at, well, where's my family been? Sherbu, and to Rabinda, another mission, and up to Cairns region somewhere, whether it was Yarraba or Mona Mona, we never found that sister of my grandmother's. So I think just before we even got to that day where, you know, Prime Minister said sorry, it was just all that lead up and all that emotion that came out, and all that had been on for a number of weeks and leading up to that, it just sort of finally hit me that I listened to what was going to happen, you know, like a milestone in this country history. I guess that for me after that, it was just full speed ahead to try and, you know, get this luncheon organised for the community in Brisbane. After getting all that infrastructure and the bookings happening, we thought, okay, well, it's coming closer to 12 o'clock and the community's gathering now. So as we actually came out of the offices, the people were just everywhere. You know, the hall was full. Outside of the lawn area, people just everywhere, cars parked, you know. You think, well, what does it mean for each and every person that was here? Mm-hmm. My husband, he's been teaching some of the kids from the Southside Education School, so I mean, there's a lot of groups that he'd been teaching, so I said, hey, get a group together and they're going to come and do the choreography turn that day, you know, so. And on the day then, when the group got up to dance, Roman asked anyone else wants to join the group, so we had a few people just popping in off the floor, young people, old people, to get up and dance, you know. And so the significance of that choreography, the song and dance and calling and making the connection for our ancestors, you know, to bless the gathering and bless the people here and the business to be done at this gathering. And it was real touching to see the young people getting up and doing that. And looking at that group, you can see that some of those kids have been affected because their parents have been taken away. These kids grew up on missions, their families, their parents, you know. But you see that spirit still in them there. They were keen to get up and they're hungry for that. This is the start of saying sorry, it's the start of acknowledging what wrongs have been done. So I really want to see some genuine commitment from this government here to help and support making a better, you know, changes for our future for the children.
To pin Natalie down to actually do that story, Smear should get a medal because, you know, it, you know, she ended up having to record it out on the lawn outside where she works just because she only had...
She's so busy,
you know, so you heard the car in the background, but... We figured that, okay, the quality might not be exactly what we would have liked, but the stories are there, and I think it's really important that they weren't scripted stories that they just spoke, and they were oral histories cut, and it was a really good way of doing it for them too. Much better for us. Okay, Sam Wagon Watson. Okay, thank you. Sam Wagon Watson comes from a family of famous writers, and he's a famous writer himself. He's a writer and poet, and he's also written movie scripts and other things as well. He's won lots of national awards, and he's also a public arts manager. And he was very keen to do his story, and he knew exactly how he wanted to do it. So we just left him, and he went off and did it. And he had his own images, etc., as well.
One of my first jobs was as a law clerk in the 90s for the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services in Brisbane. I assisted the families of several people murdered in Queensland police custody. There was always something genocidal about those instances. And in those instances, no police officer was ever charged and no police officer or politician ever said sorry. By 2004, Prime Minister Howard was already resigned to the fact that he wasn't going to say sorry. His government and his Australia would not be responsible for the past. My great-grandfather, the first Sam Watson, worked hard, him and my great-grandmother. He was granted an exemption from the Act. They both missed out on a childhood, but no one in our family was ever taken away. On 12th of February 2008, I pulled a 14 to 15 hour shift as a security supervisor on an industrial site in Brisbane. I knew there was something significant happening in Canberra, but when you're working the graveyard shift consecutively, it just saps you. I actually slept through the apology, 7 hours deep sleep and then back to work. But when I got to work, and I worked on a site that was predominantly staffed by Polynesian and Māori workers, the boys literally formed an honour guard when I walked in. Most of these guys had lived through significant political events involving Indigenous rights in New Zealand. These men were ecstatic about the apology, where I was still trying to process it, and today even, I'm still trying to process the apology. Rudd said he'd do it, and he did. What all Australians received that day was a chance to renew their vision of history, some clarity about our national identity, and there's the clarity that the stolen generation deserve from an apology from a sincere Australian leader. I have trouble trusting any politician, any words, any forthcomings. They all have limited political shelf lives. As a writer, I visualise words as living entities, and it worried me to think that a generation of Australians through this would actually one day fear the word sorry, because in the present climate, more than ever, it belongs to the stolen generation. Sorry belongs to a future of healing, compassion and hope.
Yeah. Okay, the next story is it Nadine next? Yeah, Nadine. Nadine McDowell-Dowd. Now, she works at the State Library and as a staff member, actually. She's also co-directed short film in the year 2000, Binner's Backyard. And she actually attended the Sorry Day in Canberra. Now, she didn't think that there was anything interesting for her to do a story about because her mum was invited down for the day. But the story about her going with her mum, we found to be just... She didn't realise it was a story about her as well. It's really good. Okay, that's enough. You can see it.
My mum's name had been put forward as a member of the Stolen Generation, and the National Sorry Day Committee had kind of asked the names from across the country to be pulled together, and from there they would select 100 people to sit in the gallery while the Prime Minister made his address. My mum raised us the way she did, especially with a lot of family, a lot of community, always being involved, always knowing who your cousins and your uncles and your aunties, and having that sense of belonging in community, because she never had that. She was very institutionalised. Her life was run by the church, run by religion. I think the biggest fear for her was that the Prime Minister wasn't going to say sorry, that he was going to get everybody there and disappoint everybody. And I said, well, you know, he wouldn't be that kind of man, I don't believe, to actually shame himself and not actually go through with what he's promising to go through. And another part of that was that because they brought all these members of the Stolen Generation together, The other thing that she was scared about was having to talk about her own experiences to everybody again and bringing up that pain. When they had the dinner, she just seemed a little bit more at ease because everybody else in that room had gone through the same experience. She was able to sit and talk and talk, and I think they all talked about anything and everything for 3 days straight. It enabled her to be a lot more comfortable around other people and share it. At the orphanage, they celebrate the birthdays on Monday. Just, there are too many kids, too many cakes. They celebrate on the same day, get the same present, and it was always a matchstick doll and a little matchbox. She was just a number. Even when you get your freedom of information, you're just a number. You're not only just a number, but you're pieces of paper with black wiped out on it.
Mr. Speaker, I commend the motion to the House.
The apology for her on that day was her final kind of recognition, is that I exist. My name is Veronica Ann McDonald.
I don't know if you noticed there's a little bit of irony there in that certificate has her name misspelled, which we didn't actually notice until we'd finished making... Nadine didn't even notice until we'd finished making that.
Yeah, because we were watching
out with the... So you can see we've used a range of different approaches to put media elements together and a range of different kind of approaches to collaboration as well in those stories. So that one, that was footage taken by Nadine on her little... point and shoot digital camera on the day. She didn't have many photos. The voiceover comes from a long, extended oral history interview that's actually the very long story of her mum's experience and that everything that led up to her being invited down to Canberra that day. And then we went away and edited that down into a short voiceover. Others, as Helen said, Sam actually Sam Wegg-Watson actually wrote a script out himself and then recorded that and supplied the images and went away and worked with... He was working with Mick Rennie from 4AAA and they went away and worked together as a team to put it together. Others were very, very busy people, as with Natalie. We managed to get the voiceover after a lot of trial and error trying to find time when she could actually do it, and then the QU team pretty much... rang secretaries and different people and to try to get photos. And so I just want to wrap up. I'm not going to have time to go through all the slides that I wanted to, even though they're very pretty. It's all stretched now. I just wanted to say that we came into this because at QUT we've... been using digital storytelling in applied research projects in a very wide range of contexts, from ICTs for development in South Asia to urban development in Brisbane. And we started off using digital storytelling because the then Dean John Hartley brought Daniel Meadows out from BBC Capture Wales. Many of you will know that as kind of a real flagship use of digital storytelling. And because we were new to it, and so was everyone in Australia apart from ACME at that time, we learnt this process where everyone needs to be in a room together for 5 days. It's intensive, it's hands-on, everybody writes their own script, records their own voiceover, edits the images, and learns to make a finely crafted piece of multimedia that represents their authentic self. We quickly figured out when we started trying to roll that out into contexts that weren't, the BBC, which is not only incredibly well-resourced, but it's oriented around making really, really good quality content. And when people participate in those workshops, they're there to make something really good that they know is going to be on television, okay? But if you're using digital storytelling for something else, for example, to try to understand what the health issues are in a particular community, or to capture cultural heritage in various ways, then that starts to break down that emphasis on the participants needing to develop all the skills, the aesthetic skills and the literacy skills. And so I just want to... There's a website that... There's a big report that kind of surveys all the projects that we've done, if you're interested in that. And I just want to really, really emphasise this point that everything's kind of up for grabs. So you need to kind of understand what the elements of digital storytelling can be and really think about how they should or could be put together in your context, I think. And I just wanted to say that it was interesting with this project. I mean, we were all pressed for time. There was a limited budget. There were a large number of people participating to try and get this done. But looking back, we had a very successful kind of half-day facilitators workshop with Samir and Gitano Ban and Mick Rennie and who else?
Faith Basin.
And Faith Basin, also from the library, where we were kind of introducing people to their role as in terms of helping people to develop a script and to record their voice or to interview them. And as part of that afternoon, we actually did the traditional story circle thing where we were all kind of remembering our responses to the apology, where we were on that day, and did a kind of very rapid prototyping exercise where it was like, okay, get together in teams and try to make a script out of your memories. But then when the actual participants, when we finally managed to get them all in one room because they were all so busy, unfortunately the room had been set up so that Helen and I were sitting here and you were all the participants were all in a line like that. So that was great. That built a lot of trust. And then actually we didn't have time to do that getting to know you, trust building, collaborative story circle kind of exercise on that day. And so I think if we did it again, perhaps we would actually work with that core group of facilitators or a different group and actually make their stories first. Yeah. And, you know, of course, then you have more money, obviously, and you have another year. And you'd really use that as a pilot, I think, and then actually run more workshops within the communities or organisations or institutions where those people work. So that's my reflection on the reflections on the apology. You know, I may have another nice slide. Yes, that was the lessons from the project right there. And just these are the things that those are the things when I just get back there. And of course, this is true of any kind of co-creative or participatory project. I'm not claiming that this project was as participatory as perhaps it could be, but. It is an initiative of the State Library of Queensland, and that brings with it certain ways of doing things. So some key tensions in digital storytelling that we see, like you really have to understand why you're doing it. Digital storytelling for what? Is it to create communication media that's going to reach a wide audience and kind of get an advocacy message out there? Is it so that people can learn to use computers and develop self-confidence and that kind of capacity building, or some other thing that we haven't thought of yet, and there's a lot of them. And so that question drives all of your other decisions, right? Do I really need everyone to learn to use Adobe Premiere? Do we really need a computer lab? Or is it actually about these people have something to say, and this is a cheap and amateur way to produce media for an organisation without spending money on making a doco? And so that, as I was saying, that drives every decision about how or whether you actually run a workshop or do a kind of distributed production process. Which is, yes, I think, and we can hand over to questions. What time are we supposed to finish?
We're supposed to finish now, but we're running to this 10 minutes after both, it's 1 o'clock. But we wanted to just open it up for discussions and questions because it's hard sometimes to get an opportunity. You've got questions about projects that you're doing or to share information.
Yeah.
We haven't had really an opportunity.
And we know that.
Program that he runs for Triple A for, you know, young Indigenous people in communication and media, and the say with Natalie Albert might introduce it into programs she runs at the community centre. They were looking for people who had power, I guess, to kick these things on.
Is there going to be a...
State Libraries are going to use... This has been launched on their website.
Oh, yeah, and they're on YouTube too, which is pretty cool.
For the State Library. So they're starting to get it. And, I mean, there's 330 libraries connected to the State Library.
State Library is a distributed network, knowledge networks
that's
around
right.
the state. So we were hoping that, for example, there were busloads of kids who went down for the McKay's and, and stuff like that down to Canberra, so we're really hoping... to be able to get some stories from them, because this is all going into the Heritage Collection.
Yeah,
this is now official Queensland Cost of Memory.
Plus, this generates that because we showed it in Hopevale, and that community. Well, we had screenings at night of other films from Indigenous places, and I'd taken this up because I'd been fortunate to get a copy of it to take up with permission from these guys and. Showed it, and it was very interesting to show it in that context, also with a lot of people who've been removed and have that history and listen to the conversations afterwards, and very much so I had a number of people come up afterwards and say, I'd like to do that. So I think it generates that interest, and that's one of also the powers of, I think, of digital storytelling, is it really stimulates that in people.
And the other thing with the people that they chose, they're quite well known Queenslanders, and so in regional parts, they'll know a lot
Tiger.
Of people know
Tiger.
Tiger,
Tiger
you know. People know him everywhere. So if they see that he can make a story and that this other young person's made a story, they might feel like that they can make a story too. So it's been distributed through the 330 libraries, and they will take it up with pockets of money that they get from their own, with in partnership with State Library in Brisbane. With councils. So.
More importantly, methods like digital storytelling and oral history are now an ordinary way that the library thinks about how we collect and capture and preserve our cultural heritage. Booking that idea onto such an obviously significant national event, I think is probably the real power of this project in the institutional context.
Yeah.
In every other state, maybe South Australia, there's oral histories and literature stories aren't considered part of the normal collection.
It's sort of ephemera.
Unpublished material.
Yeah.
So it has a secret list somewhere that you have to know that it exists. And you know, if you wanted to put up an oral history interview, it's very difficult. But now State Library of Queensland, because they commissioned us to write a great report, which they are now actually doing, which is fantastic. They have put it all into the collection, so you can Google search and get digital stories, and you might get an oral history, or you might get photographs from Picture Queensland.
Fantastic.
Everything.
We were actually on the boat doing Sea Country stuff, and we had James from the library on the boat, and we were with one of the elders, Louis, who had been taken to this Cape Bedford mission, that the pastor there had just handed over all his archival material to the library, and it was up, and so we were Googling. And they were looking, he was going, there, and he was pointing out, and then he had a youngster with him going, and they then, so in that moment, they were also learning how to access the collection, but also it was completely...
And the more that you can model that individual personal experiences to the institution, the more you build those trust relationships.
Then people go in.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of gay and lesbian heritage material sitting in a warehouse somewhere under the... steps at Quack or wherever it might be, that and it's about communicating, well, actually, you know, that stuff is actually part of Queensland heritage. It's not just
and
about
we'll look after it for you.
That's
and
right.
The interesting part about that, for instance, being on the boat, what else you can do at State Library, which I was talking to a colleague about, is that they can leave a virtual sticky note about their remembrance of that, and that's actually
that's to talk about when we go up.
Yes.
KTC.
And so that can then be added to the collection.
Yes.
So
I was thinking that.